Heute zu Gast die EU-Kommissarin für Wettbewerb und Digitales, Margret Vestager.
Well, from very early on, I've had the rule that I don't meet lobbyists. If a CEO wants to pass a message, of course we can have a meeting, but you know, I cannot meet with someone who's paid just to impose a message on you. Let's go!
Go! Herzlich willkommen beim OMR Podcast mit Philipp Westermeier.
Weil die Kolleginnen und Kollegen von Instafo, also der Jobplattform für den Tech- und Sales-Bereich, von der ich hier schon häufiger berichtet habe, mittlerweile bei uns doch groß engagiert sind hier im Podcast. Ihr hört immer wieder hoffentlich von Instafo. Deswegen habe ich die Kollegen vor kurzem mal selber persönlich kennengelernt und war wirklich sehr angetan. Sie haben mir dazu erzählt, es gibt eine neue Finanzierungsrunde in die Firma. 10 Millionen werden da investiert. Das ganze Thema wird also immer relevanter. Daher nochmal hier mit Nachdruck der Hinweis: Wer Menschen sucht im Bereich Tech und Sales, denkt an Instafo. Die haben da scheinbar wirklich eine neue magische Soße gefunden, wo sie über ihre Plattform ein automatisiertes Matchmaking zwischen Arbeitnehmer und Arbeitgeber ermöglichen. Und das ist im direkten Marktvergleich dreimal effektiver, was die Quote von Bewerbung zu Einstellung angeht. Hilft natürlich auch, dass sie bereits über 100.000 passende Talentprofile auf der Plattform haben und dass man sehr, sehr schnell ins Gespräch kommt. Innerhalb von 48 Stunden bewerben sich die ersten Talente bei den Arbeitgebern oder man kann sogar als Arbeitgeber einer vorselektierten Gruppe an Talenten aktiv eine Nachricht schicken oder sie zum Chatten einladen, um sich noch schneller kennenzulernen und zu prüfen, könnte das passen. Also nicht nur ich und die Geldgeber offensichtlich glauben an Instafo, sondern auch mittlerweile über 1.800 Firmen, darunter O2, RTL, HelloFresh, MyPoster, viele, viele weitere. Instafo ist auf OMR Reviews bestbewertet, 4,8 Sterne in der Kategorie Recruiting-Plattform. Firmen, die nun Instafo ausprobieren möchten, sehr gerne. Ihr spart außerdem 500 Euro auf die erste Besetzung, wenn ihr euch anmeldet über Instafo mit Doppel-F, instafo.com/OMR. Zurück zum Podcast. In ganz Europa gibt es, glaube ich, nur sehr wenige Menschen, die so relevant, so entscheidend sind für die digitale Wirtschaft, für die Wirtschaft insgesamt, wie Margret Vestager. Deswegen stand seit ganz langer Zeit unser Wunsch, sie sowohl auf dem Festival mal da zu haben, als auch im Podcast zu haben. Endlich hat es geklappt. Und was kam dabei raus? Es kam wirklich schon ein sehr, sehr offenes Gespräch raus. Natürlich, die Frau Vestager ist seit ganz vielen Jahren Politikerin, seit sehr jungen Jahren, also weiß natürlich, wie das funktioniert. Ich konnte nicht jede Frage so perfekt beantwortet bekommen, wie ich es mir erwünscht hätte. Aber trotzdem gibt es jetzt einen ganz großen Spaziergang durch die digitalen Herausforderungen, die uns hier alle vielleicht bewegen und die Sicht von Margret Vestager darauf. Auf geht's! Yeah, welcome to the OMR podcast, Ms. Vestager. I think a long time goal of mine to talk to you. Thanks for coming.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, I think everybody who cares about digital business has heard of you and knows your story a little bit. You're from Denmark. Your parents are both pastors, I think. And then you made your way into the government by the age of 29. You were already in the government. Now you've looking back at a long career in the EU, and mostly you're focusing on tech topics, regulation, competition. What's your biggest success so far?
Well, you know, I'm not really done yet. But as you say, so far, if I can tell you an anecdote, I was in a cafe here in Brussels with my youngest daughter. And when we're leaving, there's a woman who's stopping us, and she's addressing my daughter, and she says, "You can be really proud of your mom." And my daughter's like, what is this? This is not her normal state of mind. And the woman says, "Well, you know, I have a small brewery, and what your mom has done has made it better for me to have this small brewery, because now I have a more fair access to the market." Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is what gets me out of bed in the morning, that you have, you know, fairness in the marketplace, that you have a fair chance of making it. Mm-hmm. And this is also the background for the regulation that we have been passing lately, the Digital Markets Act, the Digital Services Act, that we make the market work for people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's too early to call it a success, because it's not alone a success to pass regulation, it's a success to implement regulation. So it has a real everyday effect and enables people to have a better use of the internet and for the market to be more fair so that the many, many, many smaller businesses can get to their customers.
Is it like fairness the most important value, or is it supporting Europe? I mean, it's not always the same, I think. I mean, sometimes I feel like regulation in some countries is also protecting the country. In China, it's a big topic, like how they protect their own people. And in Europe, it feels like fairness is the most, is the highest goal. You just mentioned it. Or should it be like protecting our people? Is that the same for you?
Well, for me, it's two sides of the same coin. Because, if you look at sort of our innovation ecosystems, take an amazing Dutch business as ASML. Mm-hmm. So they are the world-class provider of the equipment you need to produce chips, mm-hmm. semiconductors. Mm-hmm. But they are not alone. They rely on a network of hundreds of smaller businesses in order for themselves to be absolutely astonishing. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the startup environment, the innovative environment in Europe, you find many, many small businesses. You might find many, many small entrepreneurs. And this is why fairness and enabling what is European is two sides of the same coin, because none of these smaller businesses would have a chance if they were not seen and respected and could enjoy an open market access. Then the big guy would just crush them.
I sometimes concerned that there's not that many European tech companies that compete on that can compete on the highest level. We don't have that many companies that are worth, let's say, over 100 billion in market cap. Maybe we have like one or two or three, mm-hmm. across all of Europe, and there's several in China and in the US. Is that a concern?
Yes, it is, because I think we failed to do a number of things 10 years ago. We failed to provide a digital single market. We failed to provide a capital market where you find sufficiently risk-willing capital, sufficient amounts of capital that is willing to go in and provide risk-willing capital and the competences it needs to scale a market. Now we have been working on both these two issues, but also, you know, the direction of digitization of technology has started a new chapter, because we are on sort of the beginning of the sort of the huge scale business to business digitization, because now everything digitalizes, mm-hmm. agriculture, transport, energy, health, industry, obviously. So since Europe has an industrial culture, an entrepreneurial culture, we have been delivering, you know, machinery for the entire world. We have a renewed chance of making it, and of course, making it big in this new business-to-business endeavor that is taking off these years.
Mm-hmm. Is there any like particular company? I mean, like obviously you're like looking at regulation a lot and like thinking about competition for European companies a lot. Is there any like foreign or especially US companies that you think are worrisome for the European consumer in particular?
Well, you know, I'm my job description is not to be at war with some specific companies. My job description is to watch out for illegal behavior. You know, companies who do not follow the European rulebook, even though they do great business in Europe. And one of the things that, of course, concerns me is that I've had not one, not two, but three already finished Google cases. Now I have another one, a big one on the ad tech stack. I've had two Amazon cases. Now I have a third one. I have a Facebook case, and I have one, two, three Apple cases. So, of course, I see that there is behavior in some foreign-based companies that is simply not what you expect in Europe. But what we see is in the European rulebook, and which is respected by European companies. And that, of course, will have to be corrected. And this is one of the reasons why we have called in regulation to complement what we can do with the specific competition cases, which is the Digital Markets Act, which will change how the market will work, and then the Digital Services Act, which will qualify both on the product side, but also on the content side, how to deal with the fact that real world rules actually also apply in the digital reality.
I mean, out of those two acts, in short, I mean, there's like long and complicated rules behind them. What is like the most important like outcome of each of them in like one sentence? Like, what do you think is they should deliver?
Well, the Digital Markets Act should deliver that giant companies are, given a label as gatekeeper. And if you are a gatekeeper, you get a number of do's and don'ts. So that the fact that you can potentially keep the gate of the market doesn't ruin the marketplace. So that, you know, normal-sized businesses, startup, mid-size, whatever, that they get a fair chance in the marketplace. And the Digital Services Act will make sure that everything that we sort of consider to be normal is also being taken care of when digital. For instance, that a marketplace should know their customers so that their business customers are not someone who's selling, you know, fake stuff or dangerous stuff or something that cannot be complained about, you know, where consumers have no rights. Mm-hmm. That a marketplace needs to make sure that these different markets, they are actually real people. And the second thing that if something is taken down and there is a lot of crap online, and part of that is illegal, hate speech, bum recipes, whatever, it needs to be taken down. But if you are in a gray zone, then for reasons of freedom of expression, of course, you need to be able to know if your post is taken down and that you can do something about it. And I think that is the benefit of the Digital Services Act, that it provides these new mechanisms to make what we do online so much safer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, out of all the examples that you've given and all the problems we are facing in digital, which one is like the most pressing to you that you'd like to solve the most and that you think is the most beneficial to society when solved?
Oh, it's really, there's the running up of problems to be solved. It's quite a long list. But one thing is absolutely fundamental, and that is that we need democracy to work. We cannot have it that decisions that shapes our society is taken in boardrooms. That kind of decision shaping our society, they must be taken by people that we have elected. And that may sound like an abstraction and something very far away, but we basically see it in everyday life. Take the new rule that an operating system provider must enable more than one app store. You know, if you go shopping for bread or milk or vegetables, whatever, if you're not happy with the quality of the produce, you go somewhere else. That you cannot do on your gadget. And I think to sort of say, well, you need to be normal. You need to enable that things really work so that we as consumers have choice. I think that is a rule that democracy have set ages ago that has been contradicted in a boardroom. I think about time that democracy comes back and sets the rules straight.
I mean, that sounds absolutely reasonable and wishful for our society. Still, I read a lot about how there's so many lobbyists trying to influence you and trying to, hinder you with that legislation. And there's like these companies are spending hundreds of millions and tons of lobbyists in Brussels and in Washington as well. Can you describe how that works? I mean, are there actually like people inviting you to dinner every night, or are there? What's the environment like? How do they reach you?
Well, from very early on, I've had the rule that I don't meet lobbyists. If a CEO wants to pass a message, of course we can have a meeting, but you know, I cannot meet with someone who's paid just to impose a message on you. That doesn't mean that I don't meet it, because then of course I meet it secondhand. Mm-hmm. I meet it because they go to people that will go to me and then say, no, maybe it will not work. Or they will sort of have sort of in inverted commas NGOs seemingly with you know small businesses, app developers, whomever, but there will be a giant behind them. And of course, we also see that they are very active in the European Parliament, and so of course you see it, but. One of the, I think, important trainings that you need in my position and as a politician is that you have an ear for criticism, that things are not well thought through and that solutions could be better, and lobbyism. So that you have a closed ear for lobbyism, but an open ear for criticism because what you have proposed is not good enough yet.
I mean, obviously, like the job you do is quite important, or maybe crucial for the future of our continent. How big is your team? Who's helping you doing that? I mean, how is the organization built? Like, who's around you, around Margaret Vestager?
Well, you know, my private office or my cabinet, as you call it, is around 25 people in total, and then I rely on. On the sort of the ministry or the directorate that does competition, which is give or take 900 people. And then, of course, I work with all the other services of the European Commission who hold expertise in all these many different areas. But I think one thing that has really impressed me, having worked in this system now for quite some years, is that you know, we can never, ever outnumber the lobbyists or the lawyers of some of these hyperscalers. But the level of dedication, you know, in my staff and the synergies when people form a team, I think actually allows us to, you know, actually to do something that is really, really useful, despite not ever being able to hire the same number of lawyers.
I totally trust that. Still, I want to ask you, what over the past years, what's been your biggest defeat, like fighting for your cause and being in that job, in that office?
Well, some of the things that I have found to be, you know, concerning and difficult is the fact that When, for instance, I have a competition case, we give a fine to punish past behavior. We say that the company will have to stop what they're doing and they cannot put anything in place that would have the same effect. And then as a third thing, they will have to repair the harm that they have done. And the last thing is really, really difficult because harm happens so fast in digital markets. You know, time is really, really, really of the essence. So I think that it has been you know, difficult and sad to see that actually in some markets, illegal behavior has been successful because competitors have died.
Any like example that comes to mind immediately?
Well, if you look at, we had a case about Google that is called the AdSense case, which is about sort of an intermediary position in the advertising supply chain. And when we got to that, and actually we were relatively fast, it took us, I think, 2 years to do the case from the time that we discovered that there may be illegal behavior at stake here. When we were done, you know, the company, it was Google, was completely dominant. There was no competition left. And when there's no competition left, well, there's nothing to rebuild. And that is another reason why these two pieces of new legislation is important, because it will set the record straight from the start and not wait for us to discover illegal behavior. We will still need to be out there on the watch for new illegal things that someone may come up with, but it will give us a much better chance to be fast enough for other businesses, for rivals, for competitors, to big tech companies, not to die in the meantime.
Wir arbeiten derzeit wahrscheinlich schon mit fast 100 Leuten jeden Tag daran, am 7. und 8. Mai ein wirklich lehrreiches, informatives, produktives, lebenswertes OMR-Festival hinzustellen für alle, die kommen wollen. Und ihr seid alle herzlich eingeladen, da dabei zu sein. Natürlich. Aber ich weiß, es gibt ein Thema und das ist die Übernachtung hier in Hamburg. Mittlerweile sind Hotels doch teurer als normal. Deswegen haben wir gemeinsam mit der Wirtschaftsförderung Bremen und mit unserem Partner HRS uns etwas ausgedacht, und zwar Hotelkontingente in Bremen. Der Trick dabei ist, man ist in einer Stunde von Bremen aus wirklich direkt am Messegelände am Hamburger Dammtor Bahnhof. Deswegen könnte man ruhig auch günstig in Bremen übernachten und dann pendeln. Das ist unproblematisch. Eine Stunde vom Dammtor aus sind es nur noch wenige Schritte zum Messegelände. Wer die Hotelpreise dort einmal auschecken möchte, findet alle Infos unter hrs.de/omr-bre wie Bremen. hrs.de/omr-bre. Wer sich jetzt fragt, okay, wer sind denn diese Wirtschaftsförderer in Bremen, die das mit möglich machen, der findet alle Infos über den Wirtschaftsstandort Bremen, über die Wirtschaftsförderung Bremen unter wfb-bremen.de. Zurück zum Podcast.
I mean, are you in discussions here and there, or like talking to European tech leaders or entrepreneurs once in a while, like people that you can mention that give you advice that you turn to and ask questions? Are you talking to Daniel Eck of Spotify, or sometimes Matthias Döpfner here in Germany, or like who are the people that you turn to, like that actually like lead those European companies?
Well, yes, I speak with European leaders. I have very good advisors here. I try to stay as informed as possible and, so to speak, on mission. Because Europe should be open for business, but Europe should have one rule book. And of course, I see that a lot of Europeans are really happy with the services of foreign tech providers. And that, of course, is perfectly fine, if they play by the book. And I think now, as said, since we are entering a new chapter of digitization, where it's more business to business, where we are in a race for the discovery of the quantum computer combined with the quantum software to make that something that is actually scalable and a real thing, when we push for more security in our fiber, experimenting and developing Open RAN. I think it's really, really, really important that Europe sort of assesses the strength that we have and build on that. Because one of the downsides of Europe is that sometimes we actually too timid about our qualities. But when I speak to business leaders, you know, I see amazing businesses that has been built also relatively fast that still holds a lot of potential.
Who do you have on your European like Decacorn or I don't know Centacorn watch list? I mean, what companies do you see here across Europe that you think, wow, they could actually be competing on the highest level?
Oh, I should not be the one to pinpoint that. That would not be fair to all the many that I could not mention. So I will not do that.
Okay. I mean, you say you stay informed. Do you follow like how, for instance, a company like Meta, like Facebook, how they are in like I think in other circles, informed circles, people discuss how they're losing some relevance. I mean, they lost a lot of market capitalization. They seem to be losing some ground in a lot of areas. Facebook is losing users. Do you feel like maybe those tech monopolies, they come and go? Is that an example for a company that might even be already leaving?
I think it's too early to conclude. But it seems if you look sort of at the longer economic history, that those who were dominant, if you can make sure that they can be challenged, then eventually they will not be dominant anymore. Because the problem for a dominant company is very often that they, you know, they stay too long on their blockbusters because, you know, it's easy. It makes you money and you can fend off, you know, upcoming competition, but only to a certain point. And when you see, for instance, the scandals surrounding Facebook, now Meta, like the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal, the information provided by Francis Hogan, you see that at least something is not what it was supposed to be. But I think it's way too early to conclude. What one should do is to make sure that there is a full engagement, both, of course, as set, changing what may be illegal, and then making sure that the many strengths that is here, that they are being played out in full. And then, of course, also to follow. I know that Facebook took the name of Meta, but they have no, you know, nothing like a monopoly on the development of the metaverse. Most of the gaming industry are developing the metaverse. A lot of different providers are getting there. And one of the things that we are considering, of course, is we need to make sure that the rules that we have for good and legal behavior, that they also apply in full in the metaverse, so that it can develop competitively.
I mean, if I may use these business terms, but are you bullish on the metaverse yourself? I mean, are you actually believing in these, like, you know, future scenarios of we all like acting in the metaverse?
Well, I think it's an interesting discussion, and it's an interesting sort of thought palace that is being built right now, because it's capturing our imagination. But one of the things, of course, that makes me concerned is if we allow technology, be that, you know, Sudoku on my iPhone or the most advanced metaverse, if we allow that to steal our time. Because time is the one sort of completely final budget that we have. And it's really important that we're not allowing ourselves to be sucked into something where we are just the consumer or the data point or the gamer or the data point on which you can make money, but we still have the time to be the creator, the interactor, the friend, the spouse with real people. And that, of course, is an as important discussion when it comes to technology, that there are limits as to how it can enrich human lives.
I mean, when I follow your work, one issue that seems to connect here is the dark patterns that you try to fight against. I mean, is that like coming to your mind as well, like now, that you think the metaverse could be like the wonderland for dark patterns where like consumers are sucked into stuff without even realizing?
Yeah, you know, I'm a huge fan of magic. I really love it.
Okay.
Because here, you know, it is labeled, you're about to be tricked. You know what is going to happen. You know, don't know how it's happening, but you know you're about to be tricked. The problem with dark patterns is that you have no idea. You are being tricked. You are being, you know, led into a certain direction. You are being, you know, manipulated to do things that you would otherwise not have done. Have you thought about it? And this is why I think it's really, really important what is in the Digital Services Act, that dark patterns, they are not allowed.
Is it like a notification already, a dark pattern in your mind, or like a, you know, like a gamification of an app? I mean, the border to like normal behavior and then behavior that is created by dark patterns is quite hard to tell, right?
Yes, it is hard to tell. Also because, of course, there are patterns that are really useful. You know, if I want to push on, you know, and a press release where I myself are quoted about something, I think, which is quite good that we have done in the commission, you know, Twitter would say to me, shouldn't you read this article before you push it on? And that is, in my book, positive nudging. But it's and it's quite obvious, but it's a sort of quite rough example of the fact that there is nudging that makes us rethink, reconsider, pause a bit before we enter into something. And as long as it's obvious, I think it's a different category, because the point of dark patterns is exactly that they are not obvious, that they are not labeled, that they're not declared. We will try to trick you. I think that is, of course, why they are frightfully effective.
Can you name one dark pattern that you like really like detested the most?
Oh no, there are many candidates. I wouldn't. Do you have one that you detest the most?
I mean, not for myself, but like right now, I'm a little afraid for my kids with like the whole story around TikTok. I mean, I see TikTok coming, and I mean the whole platform sometimes is so perfect in terms of, you know, from the business side, it's one black pattern. I mean, you get sucked into it. I notice it myself. I'm getting sucked into it, and I'm wondering like how is it going to be for young people that don't have this professional experience to be on such a platform that is so well done. And so to me, that platform seems to be like one walking dark pattern.
Well, yes, I'm not on TikTok, and that is not only because I don't dance well.
Okay. I mean, you have kids, right?
Yes, I do.
At what age did you allow them to use a cell phone?
Well, you know, they're 19, 23, and 26. So
they're allowed now.
Yes, they're allowed now. But what I saw was that the oldest, she got her first phone much later than the youngest one. And I think that is a pattern that we have allowed younger and younger children to have access to technology, and also to have access to smartphones, tablets, where the use of technology is so intuitive that a two-year-old can use it. And that concerns me because, you know, we have done really good work to make sure that there are no dangerous chemicals in feeding bottles or clothing or whatever for children, but we're not labeling, a tablet or a smartphone that here you should be concerned because it may affect the development of your child. And I would be very cautious if I had small children today to say we need to allow room and space for the development of the human brain without the rewards that comes from, for instance, the playing of games in what you find on a smartphone or a tablet.
You met many of the tech leaders that actually produce all those products we talk about in person, like a Tim Cook and a Mark Zuckerberg. When you met them in person, were you surprised? That they're actually like humble and you know, well behaved people, or like were you shocked that they are like how greedy they maybe are? What was your impression when meeting the people that you actually like about whose products you think about so much?
Well, I have a rule. I never refer from private meetings, and I tend not to give. I don't think one should judge other people in public like that. But I've met so many CEOs in my work, both from digital companies and non-digital companies, and one thing is obvious from these many meetings is that CEOs are as different as other people. The only thing they really often has in common is that they're men. I don't think actually that sort of a male stereotype is sufficiently broad to cover the differences I have seen in the many CEOs that I have met so far. And that is one, I think, of the comforting thing, that even though the business community could be so much more diverse, in terms of gender, color, age, then there is still a lot of diversity in how you look at doing business, what you want to achieve, and how you want to achieve it. And that is, I think, for me, it's a comforting experience.
Anybody in particular that you liked, that you think is doing a like well-balanced job between business interest and social interest? I mean, anybody that like stuck out?
Well, actually quite a number, but you know, I don't want to make anybody think that they have a blank check to do whatever, because you know, maybe in a couple of years we need to look over their shoulders to see if they have engaged in something that they shouldn't.
One topic I wanted to discuss with you is journalism. I mean, we try to do like journalism in a way for at least for our niche. I've been working at a huge publishing house a long time ago here in Germany, Gruner & Jahr. It ceased to exist a couple of days ago in now it's RTL. So a huge publishing house basically died, and they're all in trouble. What's your perspective on the media scene? I mean, in the US, I think there's like a lot of regions where there's no local newspapers anymore. Are we just entering a new age and it's all going to be good? Or is that worrisome to you that journalism is such a economic problematic situation?
No, I think we need to reinvent the local media because we need to know what is going on. And of course, it has changed our approach that we know a lot about what is going on and on the other side of the planet. And it's important that we know and realize that living conditions are so very different. I think that is increasing our understanding of climate change, and so very important. But we also need to know our community. And you know, the social media is not building community. It is sometimes building echo chambers. It is providing, you know, a feed for you that is very often very much the same thing. Because democracy needs journalists. Democracy needs journalists that can work in free, that uses the access to or the transparency of institutions like mine, so that powerful people like myself can be criticized and looked after, and we need to reinvent this because democracy without journalists I think will be short-lived.
Der nun folgende Hinweis liegt mir persönlich mehr am Herzen als so manch anderer Hinweis hier. Ganz einfach, weil es um die Europawahl geht am 9. Juni. Erstmalig dürfen auch 16- und 17-jährige Menschen da mitwählen und die Zukunft Europas mitgestalten. Und ich glaube, es ist einfach wahnsinnig wichtig, gerade in dieser krisengeplagten, globalisierten Zeit, dass man ein Gegengewicht hat zu den verschiedenen anderen Mächten auf der Welt. Und zwar am Ende wirtschaftlich, politisch, vielleicht sogar militärisch. Es geht darum, Europa mitzugestalten. Dazu kommt, dass Europa uns einfach wahnsinnig viele Annehmlichkeiten verschafft hat in den letzten Jahren. Sei es nur das problemlose Reisen, den Euro oder das Datenroaming ohne Gebühren. Europa ist trotz aller Kritik einfach der richtige Weg. Und das sieht auch die Hamburger Senatskanzlei so, die diesen Hinweis hier unterstützt, die aber auch verschiedene andere Aktionen unterstützt, die dafür gesorgt haben, dass verschiedene Hamburger Berufsschüler Wahlwerbespots drehen. Diese Menschen werden übrigens auch im Festival präsent sein und dort so EU-Hoodies tragen. Soll ich hier explizit erwähnen, aber es gibt den ganzen Mai über in Hamburg auch die sogenannten Europawochen, einfach um Menschen zu animieren, im Juni wählen zu gehen, am 9. Juni konkret. Ich werde es hier bei uns in der Firma auch versuchen hinzubekommen, alle dazu zu animieren. Es macht einfach total viel Sinn. Mehr Informationen, wenn überhaupt nötig, findet ihr unter hamburg.de/Europawochen oder in den Shownotes dieses Podcasts. Zurück zum Podcast. Any idea how to do that? I mean, it seems like time is running out. I mean, it seems like the economic pressures are growing and growing. And then, as I just mentioned, there's publishing houses like struggling more and more now with the paper prices increasing, like the print colleagues and you know, with like the, you know, recession times, maybe even, you know, advertising shrinking. So any idea on how to actually like make this happen, how to give journalism a new chance?
Well, the crisis that we have now is hard on everyone, you know, from the most vulnerable households who see, you know, a half or more of their income being eaten by their electricity bill, to businesses who struggle to pay for their supplies. I think there is a more long-term trend that we need to address. Colleagues of mine are working on a Media Freedom Act. The legislation on copyright should also give, you know, more fair share of what is actually being awarded. So, you know, we are trying to push so that media, publishers, journalists get a stronger position in society while at the same time fighting the fights against journalists. Because, you know, in Europe, we have had journalists that are being killed. We have journalists who are exposed to harassment by lawsuits. And that, of course, we fight as much as we can because it is put in place to silence you. If you are dragged into court and your mental space and your resources will have to go into that. So for my colleagues and me here where I work, you know, it's high priority to fight the fight against journalists and to see what can we do for publishers, for media, for journalists being able to do their job.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Australia is there's like some activities coming out of Australia. I'm not exactly familiar with them, but it seems like they are asking the platforms to pay out more to media outlets when using their content, etc. Right? Is that something you follow?
Yes, I follow that, but also I follow what happens in France very well. They were the first to implement the copyright directive. And the French Competition Authority took a very active stance in this area. And that has enabled quite a lot of deals between, I think in this case, Google and the publishers in order to have a payment. I don't know the details of the contracts that has been made. But you know, that double pressure from new legislation on copyright and the Competition Authority stepping in to make sure that where there were unfair trading practices at stake, that the balance between the negotiating partners was more equal, we could actually see that they achieved results.
If you had like one idea, one concept that you could push through without having to go through all the institutions, without having to like accept pushback and corrections and shrinking the idea, what would it be? What issue do you think really needs to be pushed through and implemented the way it's just thought up by you maybe currently?
Oh, wow. Such a magic wand. It's always a bit tricky because a genie in a bottle can also, you know, really turn its head on you. No, I'd say one of the things that I would really wish would be that the tech community was more diverse. Mm-hmm. You know, technology is shaping our societies. And we try to do our best to make sure that technology is serving society, that people feel that they can use technology to create societies that are livable. But I think that if the tech community would be more diverse, more women, more generations, you know, more colorful, it would be easier for technology to develop in a way that developed society and where everyone thought that they were empowered. Because I think right now, a lot of people, they feel that they are just a data point, that they're just there for someone else to make money. And that, I think, is so far away from what I wish for each and every one of us as how we see ourselves and how we see ourselves in society.
So in a way, you would also wish for more people to actually participate in politics?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. And also to see politics in a much broader way than having to enter a party and having to run for elections and having, you know, to have a political career. But to enter into the politics of your neighborhood, you know, be more active where you work, to say, well, I have my job, but I also, you know, want to contribute in other ways. And I think in particular, there is a need for more women to take part in some of these really, really essential developments. There are so many female entrepreneurs and startups. They have huge difficulties in getting funding. So, you know, the most difficult thing to change in the world is culture. So if I really had a magic wand, it would be to deal with a culture that disables women to play their full role, because I think it will also serve men very well, because then the male role could be much more diverse than what we see today.
What were you thinking when your Finnish colleague, Sanna Marin, the Prime Minister, a couple of days ago was going through the media with her personal social media dance situation? I'm sure you followed that. What were you thinking when you followed this whole reporting on those incidents?
I was like, has the world gone crazy? You know, what an amazing prime minister. And I think you are a much better prime minister if you dance.
Okay.
Because, you know, no, I really mean that if you just work, and you never sort of zoom out and get your shoulders down, then I think there is a risk that your work is not good enough. Because we want human people to govern us. And I think that is exactly what they got in Finland.
What's your outlook for Europe? I mean, there's so much talk and the media is full of problems. The war, obviously, recession, inflation, energy, there's so many things. Is your outlook on Europe accordingly problematic and concerned? Or are you like optimistic? Like, how is Europe in 5 to 10 years?
Well, as you say, I don't think we've had this many crises before. And looking back, we have actually been in a critical situation for a very long time. You know, financial crisis, refugee crisis, pandemic, energy crisis, biodiversity crisis, war in Europe, and the climate change urgency that is making everything worse. And you know, it has made me realize that there's nothing to turn back to. It is as if behind us, you know, there is just a cliff. So in going forward, in managing all these critical situations, so that people see that they are seen and heard when they are suffering, we need to manage these crises while preserving, you know, what we want to achieve long term, like being, you know, a carbon neutral continent, like making sure that societies are not polarized and that digitization work for people. Because if we only handle all these crises day by day and we lose sort of sight of where we want to go, we'll never get to where we want to go. And this is, of course, why what we have been discussing about technology, how we regulate it, how we govern it, that is why this is so important, because that gives this perspective. We actually do know where we want to get to. And if you know that day to day, then it becomes, I think, maybe not easier, but your crisis management will be better.
Do you follow the developments in climate tech a little bit? I mean, obviously, climate change is maybe the most fundamental of all these problems and most like long term. Are you close to the developments there? I mean, in the end, that's where technology is supposed to help us or like maybe save us.
Yeah, there will be no fighting climate change without technology.
Yeah.
It's not doable, because what we need is a completely different sort of resource management, and that can only be done with digital tools. So you know, it's really important. We cannot have a well-functioning electricity market without a digital management of that. We cannot, you know, tech resources that we need to reuse without digital. You know, we're in the process, there is a giant process to digitalize batteries so that we know for how long they can be recharged and when they should be put in, maybe serve, you know, more passive energy storage use and when they should be fully disassembled and the resources to put into another use. You know, there are hundreds and hundreds and thousands of examples of climate tech that is absolutely essential. So this must be, but the thing is that we will have no transition if it's not perceived and is for real a fair transition. If people feel left behind, no real digital transition. If people feel left behind, no really fighting climate change. So everything comes together, and that of course is making it really important that one can breathe and relax and take action also in extremely complex situations.
But you're confident those, I mean, like I imagine you're like in the middle of everything and there's so many informations coming to your desk. are you confident this is in the end solvable at all? I mean, there's like a way out of all these troubles?
I think so. You know, and I see my colleagues, European citizens, myself, we invest our lives in doing this because the alternative is really, really grim, both when it comes to wilder weather, but also when it comes to the societies we want to live in. You know, right now, the Ukrainians, they are sacrificing their lives. We have hardship in Europe, and a lot of people pay very, very high costs for their heating, for their electricity, for their food. And if we don't do anything, well, we will have more wars. We will have higher costs. So we have a really grim alternative. And the fact that we have a lot of potential, of course, for someone like me, is really encouraging, that mix of a really bad alternative and a lot of potential that we have not unleashed yet.
Maybe last question. Are you going to be a politician for life? Is that your like a lifelong career? Or is there like a Margaret Vestager in the future imaginable, like somewhere in the business world or outside of politics at all?
Well, you know, I never wanted to do politics. I only came into politics sort of by mistake, because I have difficulties in saying no okay. to something that I find to be interesting. But what I did before I was sort of a real politician was I would try to, you know, influence my surroundings to see this. I think this can be done better. So this was my approach from very, very early age. So probably this is not something that will rub off. So in politics or somewhere else, if what I do can be useful, I think you'd find me there.
So there's a future outside of politics, maybe.
I see that. I see, you know, the huge majority of people, they are living perfectly happy lives without politics. So it's obviously doable.
Okay. Margaret, thank you very much for doing this and for fighting this fight, or like, you know, for being so active for our continent, for us in the end. I really trust you're doing this for the right reasons and really feel like you're doing a good job for Europe here. And thank you, from me and I think from so many listeners. Thank you very much for doing
this. You know, it's really kind of you to say so. It means a lot to me.
No, but it is true. I talked to so many tech people here in Europe and they really admire your work. And I think there's a lot of respect and a lot of, I say, gratitude, just that there's somebody doing this and being deep into the issues and not afraid. And I think you're really doing a great job there.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Unser Partner Influence Vision, influence.vision, ist der Influencer-Marketing-Marktplatz, bei dem verschiedenste Advertiser wie Samsung, Henkel, AirUp, die Group M oder ihre Creator finden, und zwar nicht einen, sondern hunderte von Creator, mit denen sie dann sehr, sehr effizient über diesen Marktplatz zusammenarbeiten können. Am Ende geht es darum, die Zusammenarbeit mit Creatern zu vereinfachen, Prozesse des Kampagnenmanagements auszulagern auf die Plattform, natürlich auch die passenden Influencerinnen und Influencer zu finden, rechtssichere Verträge abzuschließen, detaillierte KPI-Reportings anschauen zu können. All das ist über die Plattform möglich. Wer Lust hat, Influence Vision kennenzulernen, jeder ist eingeladen. Die Lösung passt für jede Branche, jede Unternehmensgröße. Es gibt sogar verschiedenste Preismodelle, die sich jeweils dem ausgewählten Werbebudget anpassen. Ihr bekommt am einfachsten alle Infos, wenn ihr bei Google Influence Vision einfach eingebt und dann einen Demo-Call ausmacht mit dem Team. Oder noch besser, ihr besucht die Masterclass von Influence Vision am 7. Mai um 10.45 Uhr natürlich auf dem OMR Festival. Alle Hinweise hier auch nochmal in den Shownotes oder unter influencevision, einwort.com.
Zurück zum Podcast.
Dieser Podcast wird produziert von Podstars bei OMR.